Hello and welcome. My name is Stephen McGall. Today on the show, how a group of medical students managed to make it home after being stranded in Peru. Concerns over the privacy of asylum seekers after the federal court releases the details of hundreds of applicants. And domestic violence services record a disturbing increase in cases in New South Wales. Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, this is The Wire. Tuning in, we'll have all of that and more for you over the next half hour. But first, a group of university students left stranded on their medical exchange in Peru have finally returned home. The Wire's Courtney Thomas spoke with Griffith University students Dakota McConnell, Lauren Marcos and Daisy Lee about how they managed to escape the country during its COVID-19 lockdown.
While Australia's managed to have a slow lockdown process for containing COVID-19, other countries like Peru didn't give much warning, leaving students Dakota McConnell, Lauren Marcos and Daisy Lee stranded with no way to get home to Australia. The three Griffith University students were on their medical exchange program when events suddenly turned in the wrong direction. Dakota McConnell says he wasn't sure he was going to find his way back home.
Before the lockdown was actually put in, nothing was really wrong. There was no indication that anything was going to happen in Peru. I mean, we were just doing our sort of normal things. We actually did our weekend trip to Lake Titicaca, and it was the day that we got back, like the night that they announced the whole country was going into lockdown and we wouldn't be able to go anywhere or do anything. So it was a bit of a shock. It all just sort of came out of nowhere. And then initially we thought that the lockdown might just end after the 14 days, as they initially said, but as time went on and things sort of got more dire, it became a bit more obvious that we were stuck and there was nothing we could do or no way to get out. We started to get a bit worried about being able to get home, back to our families and back to study and stuff like that.
Not only were they affected by closure of borders, but their peers were left stranded, unable to return home to their families.
There actually ended up being five of us. So the three of us were in one apartment together, and then we made two friends that were from a medical school in Exeter, in England, in a different apartment but in the same complex. So they actually ended up getting stuck as well. Same situation, they struggling to get flights home and stuff like that as well. So it was all a bit scary, but we had each other to sort of lean on and talk.
Despite the long trek to Sydney, the three students still have to find a way back to the Gold Coast.
The repatriation flight was organised by a private Australian company, and then that company worked with, I think, government officials here in Australia to get the approvals done. But it was quite an expensive ticket, and then it was quite a journey to get from Peru back to Sydney. And obviously we're now in lockdown here in our hotel in Sydney for the next 14 days. And then after that, we have to try and arrange transport to get from Sydney back to the Gold Coast. So we'll probably end up having to hire a car to get home, just because of, obviously we have luggage for our international trip to take, and there's three of us. So it's just going to be a bit easier for us to get a car and drive over the border. But yeah, we don't know what sort of challenges we might face trying to get home still at the moment, given that things continue to change on a daily basis.
Student Lauren Marcos is also quarantining in Sydney. She says the lockdown experience was so unexpected.
We sort of knew that we were in a country that obviously, you know, didn't have a health system that was as up to speed as Australia, for example. And obviously, I think into government forces, there tended to be a little bit less, I guess, communication at times. Like, for example, how we just sort of overnight found out about the border closures and whatnot. However, we overall just experienced that we sort of can't put words to. We've all kind of tried to discuss with each other, like, what would be the best sort of word to describe it, and we kind of can't put words to it.
She says there's a lot of misconceptions about the quarantining process.
I think there might be a bit of misconception as well. Like, for example, a lot of people were saying to us, oh, like, how great, you've been put up in a five-star hotel, whatnot. which we were lucky enough to be put up at the Marriott in Circular Quay. I guess, you know, the comfort of the beds and having maybe a nice bathroom, like you're still stuck in a very small room and, you know, you don't get any contact with the outside world. And even like giving meals and things, they leave it like a little cloth at the front of your door, so you don't even really get contact with people serving your meals. So it is, in terms of like mentally, can be quite a taxing time. So just for, I guess, the public to be very mindful of that, and especially us coming from Peru and others who come from Peru who already did a 14-day isolation.
Daisy Lee says her trip was a surreal experience with the lockdown.
We were in Cusco, not Lima. There was maybe one case of coronavirus at the time. No one was really panicking. No one around us was panic buying. Like, no one was really had any mind or any thoughts about it, really. Everyone was just going about their day. And then the lockdown happened quite suddenly, so we weren't really expecting it to happen.
While the trip back home was unnerving, many Australians are still stranded in Peru and other countries across the world.
Really trying to get help for any of the Australians that are still stuck in Peru overseas, just because it's the Peruvian government, I think, is very leaning more towards extending that lockdown period. So I think it's just going to get much harder for Australians overseas in Peru, or I guess, well, anywhere overseas to get back home. It'd be really great if everyone could really help.
And that story was by Courtney Thomas. The federal court has confirmed the personal details of hundreds of people seeking asylum were disclosed on the Commonwealth Court's database. This breach has the potential to place asylum seekers in danger, as the Refugee Advice and Casework Service warns authorities in foreign countries may use this information to enforce punishment or worse. As such, the service is now calling for the protection claims of people seeking asylum to be re-examined. Zoe Rudge reports.
The Federal Court of Australia has recently confirmed that the personal details of hundreds of people seeking asylum were disclosed on the Commonwealth Court's database. The data breach, which has affected approximately 400 people currently seeking asylum, meant that anyone on the internet could access the background information surrounding a person's claim. In light of this breach, the Refugee Advice and Casework Service, or RACS, is calling for a re-examination of the claims for protection from people seeking asylum. Director and Principal Solicitor of RACS, Sarah Dale, says this data breach may allow foreign authorities to see the claims asylum seekers have made against them.
So people seeking asylum are encouraged to give full and frank details to the Department of Home Affairs in order to have their claim for protection assessed. In doing so, they reveal very personal details about themselves, but also about the people or the bodies from which they fear harm. What the federal court does, it examines all that evidence, all those details that were provided along the way, along through the process, to ensure that that process was followed correctly. In the federal court releasing pseudonyms next to a person's full name, that means that anyone is now able to access the information that the court was examining in regards to that person, meaning that anyone can find the details of that person's fears and indeed what claims they've made, what arguments they've put forward as to why they need protection. So we've ultimately ended up in a situation where a potential abuser can know what a victim has said about them.
Ms. Dale says, unlike the 2014 data breach, those affected by the latest data breach were in the latest stages of their protection visa application, and therefore the impact of the breach is unable to be considered in their application.
The 2014 data breach by the Department of Home Affairs didn't disclose the person's claim. It released their names, their dates of birth, and identified them as being in detention. What's so consequential about the data breach of the federal court is that a person's claims and personal details, what they feared in their home countries, can ultimately be accessed and linked back to them. So this is far more significant data breach. And, you know, as we know, in 2014, many of those people had not had their claims assessed yet. So there was the opportunity for the department to consider what impact that data breach might have on a person's situation. But as people are in the federal court and the federal circuit court, they're realistically at the end of the line of that application. So without the minister intervening, they have no ability for that to be considered in terms of what impact that might have on them if they are returned to their home country or their families who remain there.
As such, Ms. Dale and the RACS are calling for the Minister for Immigration to allow those affected by the breach to begin a new claim.
It's our position that the Minister for Immigration has the ability to allow people to make new applications where new information has arisen. Given the significance of a disclosure like this, we would call upon the Minister to allow anyone who's been affected by this an opportunity to have their claims relooked at.
Professor Mary Croc of the University of Sydney Law School, who is an accredited specialist in immigration law, believes the federal court should investigate who had access and who actually accessed these personal details.
Well, my personal view is that the proper thing for the government to do would be to have a look at each of the 440 cases. It's possible to actually see who has accessed the data from the database. The last time they actually asked KPMG, the accounting firm, to do an investigation and inquiry, my view is that the federal court should do the same and see whether there is reason to be concerned about breach of the privacy.
And that story was by Zoe Rudge. Since the beginnings of radio, there have been myths and conspiracies about the dangers of radiation associated with telecommunications. Recently, people have even made links between the spread of the coronavirus and 5G networks. Monica Adair has this story.
Living in the 21st century, having a mobile phone and laptop is almost a true necessity. As the new 5G networks are introduced, they promise downloads that take seconds, seamless streaming, and real-time gaming. With conspiracies popping up around the globe that the networks have even played a role in the spread of the coronavirus, the question is posed, will there be a price to pay for these modern-day luxuries? More importantly, will the use of the new 5G networks increase our exposure to radiation, and is that radiation harmful? Senior scientist at the Australian Radiation and Nuclear Safety Agency, Dr. Karapetis, said although a frequency of radiation is emitted from a range of telecommunication sources, they are not harmful to human health.
There is no established evidence that the electromagnetic energy comes from 5G networks is harmful to human health. 5G emits what we call radio frequency radiation or radio waves. Radio waves are emitted from a range of telecommunication sources, including television, radio, Wi-Fi, mobile telephony and the sort. We've been exposed to, for example, radio for the last 100 years. The level of radio waves in the environment are extremely low, and at such low levels, there is no established evidence of health effects.
There has been lots of research into whether radio waves cause harm. However, Dr. Karapetis says that it is only harmful when at very high levels.
The only established effect of radio waves are at very high power levels. Radio waves can increase temperature. An example of that is your microwave oven at home. So inside your microwave, there's really powerful radio waves, and that can cause extreme heat. That's how you warm up your food. But in the everyday environment, the level of radio waves from, you know, mobile telephony, Wi-Fi, TV, radio are extremely low. The radio waves inside a microwave are really, really powerful, but they're enclosed within the microwave. When you open the door, that stops. The level of radio waves that you find in the everyday environment from mobile telephony, Wi-Fi, and those sorts of sources is thousands to millions of times lower than what you would find inside a microwave oven.
Although there are studies which claim that radio waves are dangerous, usually these are cherry-picked and the opposing evidence is discarded.
Now, some people have put out theories whether radio waves can damage human health by a non-thermal way. There are some studies that have shown the possibility of effects, but when you look at all of the evidence together, rather than just cherry-pick a number of studies, when you assess all of the evidence in its totality, there's certainly no evidence of harm.
Dr. Karapetis says that there are two different types of radiation. One is harmful to human health, while one is not. These are called ionizing and non-ionizing radiation.
This type of radiation is different to, like, nuclear sort of stuff, and it's different to radiation from the sun, for example, you know, ultraviolet radiation, which is known to cause skin cancer. So ionizing radiation, which includes stuff like X-rays and gamma rays and nuclear type of stuff, that type of radiation can, if you can think of, do you know that picture of all matter comes down to atoms, basically a nucleus, and it's surrounded by electrons. Ionizing radiation can remove electrons out of their orbit, and that can cause DNA damage, which can lead to cancer. cancer. Non-ionizing radiation doesn't have enough energy to do that, so there is no direct damage to DNA. So that's the difference. So radio waves, that's 5G and other types of telecommunications, they're classified as non-ionizing radiation. So there is no direct DNA damage that could lead to cancer.
If people are very concerned about the effects of exposure to radiation from technology, Dr. Karapetis says that there are ways that you can reduce your risk of any possible exposure.
The biggest exposure that a person gets from telecommunications is when they use their mobile against their head. I talk on my phone against my head. I'm not worried, but if you were worried and you wanted to reduce your exposure, you can reduce your exposure by using your phone on speaker mode or using your hands-free kit. So that's keeping your phone away from the side of your head, and that will decrease your exposure by hundreds of times. So if you're really worried, you can do that if you wish.
A new website has been created to help those who are in need of supplies during the COVID-19 crisis. The Wire's Alex McKenna spoke to web developer of Angel Next Door, Amir Kutub, to find out more.
So Angel Next Door is an online community help website. It allows you to connect with your neighbors and help each other. If you need something, you can post a help request. Everyone in your neighborhood will see that request and they will be able to respond to you and help you, all keeping it anonymous and discreet. So people don't see your contact details directly or they don't see your identity, but they are still able to connect to you and help you.
So what gave you the idea to create the website?
So it's funny story. I actually ran out of toilet papers myself. I didn't know what to do at that point of time because I needed toilet paper. So my sister was 3 blocks away from me, so I just gave her a call. And I asked her if she had some toilet paper, so she was able to help me. Then I thought that I can seek help because I know someone in my neighborhood, but there would be a lot of people who wouldn't know people in their neighborhood, or they wouldn't have contact details of all of the people. So what if we could create a network where people can seek help easily, but discreetly, because Facebook groups and all of these things out there, they expose your identity and make you vulnerable.
Are there any websites that do similar things to what you've created?
Well, ours is a completely community-based system. So it's based on the same phenomena like what Uber does, but Uber does it in a commercial way. And what we are doing is we are actually democratizing the whole help thing. So if someone needs help, they can just put it out and people out there would see that request and someone would make an offer to help. It's all 300% community-based, and I don't think there's anything that exists out there. Even Queensland government is trying to do Help Army to help older residents, but again, they're just registering via a phone call or filling in a form. I don't think they have a system to be able to identify who needs help and then provide help efficiently through an online system.
So who's the target audience for this site?
Well, it's everyone right now at the moment because we all are in some sort of lockdown. A lot of people are willing to help, but they don't know how to help because I'm willing to help, but I don't know all of my neighbors and all the people. I'm not sure who needs help. And similarly, the people who need help, they don't know where to go. So this is basically connecting both of these people and targeting everyone out there. But I think this will be specifically useful for people who are under self-isolation, who are under quarantine, or especially the people in the older age group who are high-risk people and they need to stay home.
So do you think this site could be used after COVID-19 is over?
Well, I think one of the things that COVID-19 is doing to the community is bringing the community together. It's like old times, you know, when we used to have a closer community and everyone used to help each other. But people are coming to those basic things and willing to help each other. If we can create this as a campaign, as something that can be followed later on, I think this website would be a fantastic way of allowing people to help each other.
And that story was by Alex McKenna. Domestic violence support services in New South Wales are seeing a spike in client numbers and an escalation in reports of violence over the past week. Chief Executive Officer of Women's Safety New South Wales, Hayley Foster spoke to me earlier about this disturbing trend.
This week we're seeing, again, an increase in the number of workers that are noticing client number increases. The more workers are identifying high-risk clients and complex cases, and more workers are also identifying that there's violence and abuse that's specifically related to COVID-19, escalating and worsening violence because of COVID-19, and also violence and abuse occurring for the first time as a result of COVID-19, which is quite concerning.
When you say complex cases, what do you mean by that?
We mean that not only we might be seeing escalating violence, so you know, where the victim survivor might have been doing what she can to de-escalate the abuser, to keep herself and the children safe through whatever means that she could in the past, and she'd been utilising these strategies and had safety plans in place. These are not necessarily working, so you might have an increase in the escalation. You might have additional alcohol abuse, stress, external stresses. Everybody is locked in their homes together. You've got children around at all times, so children are being exposed to extreme levels of violence and abuse as well. And you've also got a lack of access to the court. So the court services have been reduced. So you might have partners who have separated after violence, but there's a ramping up of the dynamics around shared care because of, dealing with the realities of COVID.
Right, so all of the normal protections people might have had aren't as available as they were a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah, that's right. And people who are experiencing violence are having difficulty even reaching out for the support that they need, for their safety and well-being. Even making a phone call for support services or to call the police can be extremely difficult. Often we would have women who would call the police after he'd gone to work for the day, for example. That can't happen in a lot of cases right now. So in some instances we're seeing a reduction in calls to police in various locations and a reduction in calls to services, because women are not being able to actually reach out for support when they need it. And that's a serious concern to us. Then when women do come through the phone lines and come through police, we're seeing, really serious cases. They've literally called the police because they thought they were going to be killed. So the stakes are getting higher, things are ramping up, and at the same time as we're seeing, those more severe, escalation of violence and abuse, we're also, the service system itself is really under pressure. We haven't yet received any additional resourcing from the government in assisting moving to a working from home or a remote location to provide services online and over the phone, because all of these changes are happening very quickly. We know the government is making inquiries now as to what support services need, but services are under the pump trying to make the changes to their service models to be able to still provide services in this new COVID-19 environment, while all the while the pressure is rising in terms of the complexity of clients that they're working with. So it's a very, very tough environment, and even to refer clients onto services. What was found is that this week that's increased to 75% of the frontline workers we surveyed have identified that there's just insufficient service availability options to refer clients to other services.
And that was Chief Executive Officer of Women's Safety New South Wales, Hayley Foster, speaking to me earlier. That's it for us today. Great to have you with us wherever you are in Australia. The Wire is a collaboration between Radio Adelaide, 2SER in Sydney and 4EB in Brisbane, and we're produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and Community Radio Network. You can hear us again same time each weekday on your local community radio station, you'd like to catch up with us, just go to thewire.org.au for more information and to see all of our programs and stories. While you're there, why not send us some of your story ideas as well? We'd love to follow up on some of those for you. Today's program came to you from 4EB in Brisbane. My name is Stephen McGall. Thank you so much for your company, and we'll see you next time on The Wire. It's like a